Support for this podcast comes from Frito-Lay and the 2023 Snack Bracket Championship. The Frito-Lay Snacker Challenge is underway, and fans are voting on their favorite snacks to crown champion. We're talking about primetime matchups between the best 64 snacks in the land. Will Ruffles Ridges reign supreme? Can Doritos defend their dynasty? Or will Smart Food use their smarts for a surprise upset? Only you can decide. Get in on all the action for a chance to win up to $1,000 or a year's worth of snacks. Let your snacks be heard. Just go to FritoLaySnackIt.SBNation.com to vote and enter for a chance to win. No purchase necessary. Sweepstakes ends April 3rd, 2023. Void where prohibited. Year's worth of snacks awarded in the form of 52 coupons, each good for one bag of chips. See official rules at FritoLaySnackIt.SBNation.com.
Hey there, welcome to ATL and 29, a Peachtree Hoops podcast where we look at the NBA from the starting point of Atlanta. Glenn, lots of stuff has happened since the last time we recorded. How about that Magic game?
That was something. You want to break that down?
They did a good job manipulating the Magic defense.
They did, and the defensive plan against Jokic I thought was really good. Especially considering that they had key people out, we could talk about that if you want to.
Speaking of the defensive game plan and not wanting to, that may have been a little bit of the issue from shoot around with wanting to discuss the defensive game plan or not on Jokic.
He's unique, and that's one of the more important shoot arounds, walkthroughs, whatever it is. But that you'd think that would be one of the more important ones to get everybody engaged in, I think.
Yeah. Actually, something that I had not connected the dots on until just now, jarring the brain, is that I think we mentioned before that at one point this season, when comparing this season to last, Jalen Johnson was like, yeah, we're taking shoot around a little bit more seriously this season than we did last season. Mm-hmm. Nate's trying to do that, and that caused some issue this weekend.
Yeah, I mean, so if we can kind of tie a few things together. So against Denver, they were doubling from the baseline, and there is a very specific way to organize the weak side once the double takes place, and that's not something the Hawks often do. You may recall them doing that against the Knicks religiously 2 years ago in that playoff series. They would bring in the second defender across the paint, park him on the same side of the floor as Randall was, usually in the mid or low post and kind of that vicinity, and force Randall to be a playmaker. With Jokic is one of the best passers in the league, regardless of position. So you have to have everything else organized to do that. And so I don't want to presume too much about what did and didn't happen, and the whole Trey and Nate thing, which we're kind of approaching, I think, in our conversation. But there was a lot of specificity to what they did on defense that Friday night game versus Denver. That doesn't mean that I think that how Nate handled it, per what we know, what we've heard. I don't even want to say no. In this situation, I want to be careful to like. Yeah, I think our words are important. What do I know? What do I think? What do I believe?
Sure.
And to be precise in that way. But if
I believe the Nuggets, the defensive game plan against the Nuggets was a key issue for Friday morning.
For sure. And it was of, I think, elevated importance because of what Jokic forces you to do because of his ability to score and pass and create, from all many different spots on the floor. And the team that played executed really, really well. That's the primary reason, in my view, they got the win. So I can understand a coaching staff, a head coach, wanting to emphasize how important it is for everyone that's going to play that night or might play that night to be present and engaged for that session. So I'll kind of start there. I don't want anyone listening to think I'm going to be one-sided in this. I'm not. But I, as a coach, I would understand. And now, obviously, I've never coached the NBA level, never coached someone like Trey. But just generally speaking, there are situations where you really want everybody to pay attention, because the planning, the scheme, the implementation, based upon the opponent, requires a lot more depth of implementation and such. And it does seem like that was the case on Friday, because they did a lot of things on Friday night defensively that they don't normally do.
Fair enough. If the Shams report is true, I mean, what could Nate have done differently, you think, to approach that situation if it went down the way it was described in that report? Is there another way to do it besides an ultimatum? I mean, that seems like, you know, I guess reportedly he offered that Trey could come off the bench, which you figure, you know, that's the, you know, if you can't help us with the game plan, then maybe you can play in the non-Jokic minutes or something like that, at least, you know, for the beginning of the game, something like that. I don't know. You know, again,
yeah, and maybe
I believe, but I mean,
right.
Essentially, though, that becomes an ultimatum. Either, you know, the two choices that were offered were sort of either, you know, come off the bench or just, you know, stay home for the evening, which appears to be what happened. They had Trent Forrest and John Collins and DeAndre Hunter out of uniform but on the bench, and Trey was reportedly not in the building.
Yeah, so I mean, so this part of the conversation is assuming the reporting is accurate.
For sure.
To be clear, one stakeholder or a set of stakeholders who had a common goal here wanted a specific narrative to get out. That's usually what happens, is that someone wanted a certain narrative out, because the narrative makes, in my view, makes Nate look pretty bad. So I don't think it was Nate or the team, okay. You know?
Yeah,
and then
it seems plausible.
Yeah, and then also, like, Clutch doesn't do business with Woj, right? and teams do tend to do business with Woj, right?
Right.
That's kind of the way it kind of goes. So I think that probably matters in how we connect the dots a little bit. I wouldn't state that as like something I know happened. Like, I don't know who put this out, but it does seem to paint Trey in a little better light, or a more sympathetic light, and Nate not the best light. So for me, if I'm dealing with a player that feels like he needs to focus on rehab and get his body ready for that night, I don't know, in a vacuum, I don't know why you can't give him a special session with an assistant coach to talk through, like, maybe while he's even getting treatment.
Right.
This is what we're going to do. I mean, teams use video these days, right? And there's a lot of, there's more ways to accomplish that other than Trey showing up for the walkthrough. Now, would it have been as effective? You know, probably not. There's limitations to that. You want everyone to hear the same thing. You want everyone to hear questions that are asked by the players and coaches. You want all that clarified together. So I understand Nate feeling strongly about having Trey there. Now, had things not broken down and Trey not skipped the game, you know, my sense is that probably the way that plays out is that he comes off the bench in the first half, observes the way the team is defending,
right,
gets a feel for it, and then by no later than the time the second half starts, he's in his normal rotation and all that. But why Nate can't say, hey, you know, if you can't come to shoot around or walk through or whatever, we'll bring you off the bench just so you can get a look at what we're doing defensively, and then we'll, in the second half, we'll get you into your normal rotation. In my mind, there had to be some middle ground there. We'll bring an assistant coach to you to talk you through what the plan is, and or we'll let you watch the first quarter or the first, you know, until Jokic goes to the bench like he does normally with about 2 minutes to go in the first and third quarter, and then we'll get you in. And once you've had a chance to see that, we'll roll you through, you know, the normal rotation the rest of the way. So it just feels like there should have been a middle ground that could have been achieved there. Now, what we don't know is if Trey and Nate have been butting heads for a while, you know, Nate may have felt like he needed to, maybe even to demonstrate to the rest of his team that he is the authority figure and that he wants Trey to be coachable or accountable or whatever that is. And so it's, you know, in a vacuum, I think there are other solutions than what Nate proposed, but that may be lacking the context of weeks and weeks or months of conflict that may have made Nate feel like he needed to take a more hierarchical leadership posture than one normally does with a franchise player.
That just makes too much sense. Can't we be more salacious?
If you want to, but I mean, there's salaciousness is out there on Twitter. I mean, every theory is already out there. We can't create a theory that's not already out on Reddit or Twitter or wherever else it might be. Instagram.
Well, okay. Now, how about this? And it's not an attempt to be salacious, but Trey's been around for a number of seasons now, and it feels like in previous seasons, if there was conflict, there wasn't necessarily high-level peers on the roster, save for maybe John Collins. Is it different now with some other people around? Is it different with DeJounte around in terms of, the respect of his peers on the team and what might happen in his absence?
I think that is definitely part of the dynamic of bringing DeJounte in. You know, DeJounte has made an all-star team. DeJounte comes from an organization where the culture has been established for, 30 years, if not more, right? Expectations are pretty clear on, you're going to check your ego at the door. Pop says all the time that the first requirement to being part of the Spurs organization is to get over yourself. You'll see that reference a ton. And so it wouldn't surprise me, even though DeJounte doesn't have a perfect track record, like in the Houston game, he was quite immature in that game. But I thought he took a mature approach, like when Lauren interviewed him right after the game and said some things that were not directed at anyone by name, but seemed to be sending what he felt was an important message, and I don't, until this season and until DeJounte was on the team, I can't think of anyone who would have felt like they were empowered enough to say something like that, even though no names were mentioned. I thought he was fairly diplomatic about it while also not watering the message down, Sure. So, in my mind, this is a new challenge for Trey. It's not, and I don't want this to sound as negative and critical as it may, but it's not just the Trey show now. They've tried to upgrade the roster, put more upper level, kind of players and talent, kind of around Trey. A lot of us want to map that back to the Miami series last year, but the problem was bigger than the Miami series, even if that brought it into the clearest focus that that it's ever been brought into, But I do think, like, high level players, in a constructive situation, they hold each other accountable, and they challenge each other to be better, and they challenge each other to think a little differently about how they're approaching things. I don't think that's a bad thing.
There's definitely a scenario where this ends up being a very positive outcome. Like, just shake it out and get it over with. And I this isn't necessarily a doomsday thing. And I think a big reason for that is the high level talent that's on the roster, where peers keep peers in check.
Yeah. And on top of that, I think there has to be some likelihood that if Trey doesn't get up to the rough start, that this doesn't become as big of an issue in Trey's mind. Right. I've shared that, like, the first 5 to 8 games or so, Trey and DeJounte were giving each other a ton of space, and not forcing the other to fit into their style of play or the style of play that they feel best suits them individually. And I thought that was a great indication that they were going to not, force one into the other style or what have you. I think a result of that was Trey was playing off the ball. Trey was, if not playing off the ball, he was starting possessions off the ball more than he ever has. And as best as I could tell, he was struggled to kind of get and maintain a rhythm, you know. And then I think it was probably the Toronto game where he kind of went back on ball and things started clicking again. He started finding a rhythm again. And there's no doubt in my mind that someone at his level is like, okay, this is what I need to do, you know, for me to be able to produce at the level the team needs me to produce, to contribute at the level the team needs me to contribute. This is the formula that I need. And the issue there might be, well, that's good for you, but, you know, we're 22nd or 23rd in offense right now, you know? So we've got to kind of think about how to find a formula that facilitates you getting and finding a rhythm, but facilitates other guys being able to contribute from the roles that are best, you know, fit what their skills are, you know? And so I, you know, we're quarter way through the season, and it wouldn't surprise me that this is the offense is still kind of work in progress, and maybe Trey's initial struggles, the offense not improving. It's, they've kind of been in that, you know, 17 to 23 range in offensive rating for most of the season now. Nate, I'm sure, feels like there has to be some urgency to get the offense to perform better. And, you know, so I know on social media, we like to kind of always boil this down to being one thing. And I just think this is much more like it'd be 5, 6, or 7 things,
right?
That all kind of came to a head at a specific day, right, when they had a playing a specific opponent and things like that. But I mean, DeJounte, I think, made his feelings known. And, you know, Nate has to be careful about what he says, because you have to treat your franchise player as a, you know, as an important stakeholder in how things are going as any other stakeholder that really exists, you know, in the organization and the franchise. So, you know, for me, I just think that I do think that one thing that's really stirred things up, you know, not in a way that it's controversial in an unnecessary way, but I think DeJounte is probably willing to say things to Trey that no other teammates Trey's had in his time in Atlanta has felt empowered. I wouldn't say it or afraid. I don't think anyone's had the stature to right. feel like they're empowered to maybe try to hold Trey accountable in the way that good teammates do. And I do think that's a pretty big difference for this year.
And the Hawks are lucky, you know, and I sort of another reason that you could see something like this not turning out badly, and is that, you know, they have a couple of players on the roster in Bogdanovich and Capella who have, you know, both the respect of the coaching staff and Trey, like they get along with both. So there's a bridge there, and, you know, there's a path back to smoother times, especially now that Bogey is playing again and, you know, healthy enough to participate. Like I think that gives them more of a critical mass of, hey, you know, let's get this figured out. The Hawks are lucky. God, you know, Clint Capella is just such a good teammate. Like,
absolutely.
It's incredible. Like, you look at the 30 rosters and you're like, who has a 7-footer who plays incredible defense, is beloved by his teammates, runs his ass up and down the floor as hard as can be, even though he's going to take like 6 shots a game, you know, sets all the screens. You know, every now and then, like, there was one game where he's like, yeah, nobody passes me the ball unless I'm right under the hoop. But, like, man, he just, they're so lucky. Like, he's so rare. And, like, just, you know, having a guy like that, like, he's not, you know, it's obviously a very different situation than what you would have with somebody like DeJounte. But, you know, having players like that in the mix, in the picture, that can be really helpful. And it's funny, you know, with Bogdanovich and Herter, it's like, you know, you don't know like what all the possible trade scenarios and this and that were, but in some respect, you know, you wonder, like, you know, why is Bogdanovich here and why is Herter gone? And, you know, that could be one element in the equation, is that you know, Bogdanovich fits better in a situation like this where Herter would be like, what the hell is this?
I think those are all great points. I would add to that that Capella also played with James Harden. And Harden had very specific expectations. Obviously, Harden, it's sort of like Trey, like produces offense at a like historically great level. And I'm not comparing, personalities or, or whatever, but just that Capella has played with a historically great offensive player, that where there might be some parallels there. And I think that helps Capella in this situation. Curious what you think, but I also think that Kyle Korver being in the organization could be of value in a scenario like this. A lot of guys respect Kyle, and he spends it seems like he kind of has one foot in the front office and one foot kind of in, we'll say, player development or on the practice floor, practice court, or whatever. But that's something that's different than it was previously too. And that's I know that if I were Travis or Tony or Nate or whoever, that might be a guy I'd tap and see if he could kind of help with the communication around this too.
I could see Kyle being more of a guy that could help in like a rehab, like a Bogey situation where it's like this rehab that's long and arduous and he's annoyed and he wants to get back sooner. And it's like, just kind of the power of positive thinking sort of thing and, helping hype you up to the point where, you believe it can happen. Something more like that. I'm not sure that, I don't know that. I'm sure he was on some dramatic rosters and some dramatic times before, but how much he helped or can, help navigate that now, I wouldn't have much firsthand basis on which to speak with that. Like in a lot of ways, when Korver was here in Atlanta, that team was sort of the antithesis of your typical situation where it was just like, yep, here we are. We showed up for work. Let's go do what we're supposed to be doing. And it was very different.
Yeah, he just seems like a very thoughtful person and someone who is close enough but not too close to be able to kind of have some messaging that's received. I think at this point sometimes if something comes from Nate, that's tough. If something comes from Trey, it's tough. Teammates can be really helpful in a situation like this. And such, but it's hard to
Any
know.
moments,
And
Carter, unretire at age 47?
I know it's I mean like Vince helped Trey with his shooting a lot when Trey was a rookie, and from there, and stuff. But I don't know. I mean, Trey understandably got a lot of leeway his first years. He's young, and he's still pretty young, and all of that. But to your point, I think this could. I think the people involved, the people that are primarily involved, will decide: does this go in a positive direction, or do we get stuck in this place of contention and fragmentation and distraction? And so they'll decide. Trey will decide how he's going to respond. Nate will decide how he's going to respond. Others will decide how they're going to respond, and hopefully they can kind of sort this out. I'm a little concerned that it sounds like I'm giving Nate a pass here. I mean, I mentioned that I thought there were other solutions there, but I think the strongest critique or the thing to point at was if it was true that Nate said, "Play off the bench or don't come," I mean, you just can't treat your franchise player like that these days. There's got to be some other communication attempt that's more collaborative, more generates dialogue as opposed to kind of just drawing a line in the sand. Now, who knows, like how many times Nate tried to get traded, So, but I just want to make sure that it's clear. I'm saying
That's
that
fair. And just to
if the
say what
reporting,
happened. Oh, sorry. I was just
no,
going to
if the
say that.
reporting is true, that I think Nate, I think to a degree, Nate mishandled this, you know. So I don't want to point, I don't want to be like some of the people on Twitter that are like firmly taking one side or the other, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't, human beings, it's with human beings, it's almost never like that anyway, you know. But you know, I don't know what Trey, I don't know what Trey was like. Well, coach said I can't come, so I'm not going to come, you know.
Right. And so to be clear, you know, Nate was asked about Trey's absence today, and Nate didn't say a whole lot about it. He just said that it was, you know, Trey's absence was a miscommunication, and, you know, when asked to clarify what the miscommunication was, he would just say it was a miscommunication.
Right.
The miscommunication was a miscommunication. So we got into some deep tautologies there, but
doesn't that seem like Nate kind of, as one does at his level, kind of taking some ownership?
He would not say enough that we would know one way or the other. I have no idea. It was a miscommunication, Glenn.
Gotcha.
That's all. There was very little offered there. Just that, pretty much just that one word. But it's interesting because it's like, if you go to root causes, and you were talking a moment ago that, you know, one root cause here is potentially that Trey's just frustrated. He hasn't really played as well as he wants this season. And it's like, you know, that's one aspect where maybe it's a little harder to see the sunny solution, because I think what you have in Nate's offensive style and what he's looking for isn't necessarily the thing that would make Trey the most pleased, or that's not even a fair way to say it. It's just like the overall, with the conservativeness, I guess, of the offense and what they want to do, and just kind of control the game and just play in a style that doesn't have a ton of passes and doesn't have a ton of turnovers, and you just kind of keep pace on offense and win the game in other areas. You know, and then you just look at the personnel that's out there, and it's like, you know, if he's out there playing with a defensive oriented starting lineup, like, it's just, it's different than what they had last season. And so you could see why it's going to be frustrating, and that might not change soon, but there's some hope with AJ Griffin and Bogdanović. And maybe if we're moving on here, you know, we talked about the defensive game plan against Denver. You know, when you look at what they did offensively against Denver without a whole lot of offensive hubs, how did they make that game work offensively?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, kind of qualitatively, like, the energy just seemed better. The ball moved better. I don't think it was like a complete 180, you know, or anything like that from the ball movement standpoint. But, you know, just kind of one example early in the game, when the first few possessions, you know, they ran their normal setup where they have two in the corner, one in each 3-point break, and ends up DeJounte Clint running a slot pick and roll for the right 3-point break. And Jokic went all the way up to the level of the screen, and DeJounte rotated the ball to Jarrett Culver, and Culver, did something that doesn't happen much at all this year. He just attacked the space that was created because Jokic went all the way to the level of the screen. And I can't remember I think he scored on that play, but like, there were three or four times the ball rotated to the weak side early in the shot clock, and the person who caught it just attacked the space. Aaron Holiday did that one time. Culver did it three or four times. AJ did it a couple times. And, you know, when it's Trey DeJounte lineups, it seems like the default is, I'm going to catch the ball, see how the defense responds or reacts to the ball swinging to my side. And they're in a perpetual state of letting the defense reset, as opposed to attack a defense that's tilted to the strong side still and needing to recover. And so it wasn't like there was this amazing passing that's going to be on the NBA like top 10. It was a simple pass to the highest player on the weak side perimeter, and just that guy just attacking the space that was available because of how Denver was, managing there. Now, in the third quarter, it got a little harder because Denver moved Aaron Gordon onto DeJounte, and DeJounte was struggling there, but they had built up enough synergy, I think, Aaron moving Gordon's the ball and such, you know. Sorry, I missed that.
I was just trying to whisper and give some subtext. I said Aaron Gordon was hand-checking.
Oh, there, yeah. Well, I mean, he's a veteran. He knows how much hand-checking they allow, I think. But he's just a really physical defender.
Yes.
But in my mind, it's like most times the Hawks would encounter a challenge like that when they were on offense, it would get into, okay, let's ISO, let's spread everybody out, let's ISO, and let's kind of go from there. And that just didn't happen against Denver. I would never say the Hawks are better without Trey. The best Hawks team has Trey clicking, DeJounte clicking, DeAndre helping, JC helping, Clint being a defensive foundation, AJ being reliable off the bench, and on and on and on, you know. I don't even want to criticize Trey for having the instinct to want to put the offense on his back when things are bogged down. But my guess is if there's a message being shared with Trey right now, it's we've got to pick up our ball movement. We've got to pick up and get into things like they ran more delay action, which is the center at the top of the key and two guys on each side of the formation with pin downs and kind of getting into pin downs and the pistol. And they were just running a lot of stuff they haven't run in a while. And that probably has nothing to do with the fact that Trey wasn't playing. It's just, it looked like a team that was intent on moving more, getting more movement. And if Trey feels like that's the stuff that got me personally bogged down at the beginning of the year, I understand his concern. I understand how he could be concerned and just want to know, okay, you know, where do I fit into this? And where do I get the stuff that I need for me to develop and maintain the rhythm? That's the stuff for the coaching staff and the players to collaborate on together. But if that's where the conflict is coming from, I think that's a natural source of conflict. And I don't think it's an unusual source of conflict. It comes down to how the people handle the conflict. And that going forward could be constructive or it could be problematic.
It was a lot to process there. First of all, I asked Nate about that today. You know, you talked about the early shot clock passes to the weak side and just the instant attack. And a lot of it was Culver. And Nate's like, yes, we want to do that. That's, you know, he's like, I like to call that playing on the catch. You know, we want to play on the catch. And, you know, he said that they're going to see a lot of that from Oklahoma City Monday evening.
For sure.
So, you know, and you just mentioned just now with Trey, you know, being a little bit frustrated from his off-ball experiences. And, you know, that's a reasonable thing. And that, again, I think that's a little bit where you look at what's there on the roster with him. And if he had somebody in DeAndre Hunter who was a little bit better at playing on the catch, then that would go better. You make that quick cash, that catch, and you're going to decide, okay, you know, pass, shoot, dribble, like what's going to happen? And you make that decision quickly. They need a little bit more of that from DeAndre. They need Hunter to be less deliberate and more instantaneous, more instinctive. And they didn't need it as much with the roster that they had last season, but now they need that more from him. And you know, you could see why with the players that are out there that it can be hard for Trey. And so they're going to have to navigate all this and get a better feel for what's out there. So that Trey can get comfortable on offense, because if he doesn't, then, you know, it's understandably going to be tricky for them.
Yeah. If they're even like a, say 10 to 12 in defensive rating and stay like 19 to 22 in offensive rating, they're probably going to be in the plan, right, with that performance, unless they just get lucky at the end of games and win a bunch of close games.
It's not even lucky though. Part of it is just if you're, I don't know, like if they're around 10th or 11th in defense and you've got, you know, somebody in Clint Capela who's as good as he is on defense, like, you know, that's, they can put some very nice defensive lineups out there at the end of games and you're, I don't know. To me, it just feels like you're a little bit more in control with what happens in late game situations if you're,
I agree with that.
Better on defense than offense. It's just,
I just think like the goal right now should be like, okay, let's get the league average on offense. Oh, let's figure out the solution towards that, right? And then on the flip side, I would say like, if we're going to kind of critique DeAndre's offense, first of all, if the ball rotated to him more consistently, maybe starts to kind of, get that instinct to attack on the catch, like Nate says.
Oh, I've got the ball. Hold on. Let me feel this sucker for a couple of seconds.
Yeah. Let me scratch my left elbow. But I mean, at the same time, their defense has been what has bought them time to figure out the offense. And JC and Hunter have been so good on defense. So in my mind, I know you weren't doing this, but I think Hawks fans, I see it quite a lot, like, want to be like, oh my god, Hunter and JC, blah blah blah. It's like, okay, they're fifth in the East right now, or at least they were before play started today, on their defense, and Hunter and JC have been absolutely huge on the defense,
right? And not the same as last season. Like they've both made like big positive strides defensively and gotten better.
Yeah, and then if you're playing from behind, you can take Hunter off and put AJ on if that's the thing you want to do, right? So you can close with Bogey, you can close with AJ if you're playing from behind. So they have some nice, like, rotational setups to give them a chance to close out a game they're winning, to close out a game that's tight all the way, to try to come back from behind, and they have a nice mix here. We just got to get everybody on the same plan, buy in. And for Trey, I don't want to just say like, oh, Trey's not buying in. I want to say I believe, and the wording is important here, I believe he's concerned about how he gets and maintains his rhythm with the changes that are being kind of encouraged. And I think that's normal. I think it's fine. It's a matter of how you handle it, in my view.
Yeah. Very, very good. And, as of last night, I don't know what happened in the game tonight. But, as of last night, they were like fifth in the East, which is a good spot to be in to sort of figure out your problems.
Defense is a good place. Yeah, defense is a good place. Get that offense clicking, help each other, buy in, trust each other. And maybe there's an opportunity for Trey to trust guys around him and kind of go from there. Maybe there's a chance for the guys around him to say, Trey, we got your back. It's not going well for a while, but we got your back. So that's what I'd like to see.
Well, I appreciate you doing this, and hopefully we'll get to do it again soon and look at, whatever happened against OKC and some of these games in New York this week.
Should be a fun week.
Have a good night.
Thanks, Kevin. You too.